our nation, and thank you for joining us today. Wayne Elliott here from the North Shore of Lake Erie in Canada, your honored guest host with Mr. Joseph Meyer, a brilliant financial analyst, rather, and tons of experience, over 50 years in the markets. Just before we get on to cryptocurrency, Mr. Meyer and I were talking about the stock market crash in 1929, where before all the smoke cleared in 1932, the market had lost 90% of its value. And then what's just as shocking is, so that's 1932, it didn't go over, the Dow Jones did not go more than it was in October 29, before the crash. It didn't gain more value than that until 1954. That's the year I was born. But that's a lot of years in between. So Joseph told us on the last show that when there is major adjustments, whether the Dow Jones or the housing market, that it will likely be a very long time before those values increase again. We were even talking about our parents and grandparents, you know, when they were lucky enough to buy a home and get a home and eventually get it paid off. They raised their family, they stayed there, they generally died in that home and then passed it along to their child or children. And the difference in things today. So welcome back, Joseph. Let's get into the cryptocurrency.
Okay.
And give us the layman's explanation, if you would, please.
Well, let me explain one thing to you prior to put things in perspective. When you talk about the 10 largest currencies currently in the world, Wayne, you got one the U.S. dollar, two the euro, three the Chinese yuan, four the Japanese yen, five the Indian rupee, six is Bitcoin, seven is the Russian ruble, eight is the sterling pound, nine is the Swiss franc, and 10 is the Korean won. So the point being, Bitcoin is now the sixth largest currency in the world. A lot of people don't understand or realize that fact.
Wow.
That's how big Bitcoin is.
Wow. Wow. Well, explain to us what Bitcoin or these other cryptocurrencies are, if you would, Joseph. I just don't get the concept right from the ground.
They're a digitalized way of conducting transactions using the Internet. When you talk about the advantages of Bitcoin, there are many. When you talk about the disadvantages, we certainly have a few that you want to be aware of. But the four main advantages of Bitcoin, Wayne, is one, quick and cheap transactions. Number two, irreversible transactions. No paperwork and appreciating in value. The disadvantages are Bitcoins are currently not widely accepted. Bitcoin's value fluctuates and fluctuates wildly. Wallets can be lost, no buyer protection, no physical form, or no valuation guarantees. That's the negatives. So just like any asset class, Bitcoin has its advantages and its disadvantages.
But, okay. Now, how does it work, Joseph? How does one use Bitcoin? How does it acquire it, and what would we use it for? I understand
Internet
transactions.
Well, you have to buy it through a dealer, through a Bitcoin dealer. And what it does is it allows you to do transactions anonymously. There's no paperwork involved. That's what makes it uniquely different. It's an irreversible transaction. Once you make that transaction, it can't be reversed, Wayne.
So is this, are there sales taxes on Bitcoin purchases or transactions?
I don't believe so.
See, it makes you wonder, what is the government? Has the government got any position on this? How would they track income tax or revenues, and is it something that may come up?
Well, we're starting to see more regulation certainly coming forward, not only with Bitcoin, but more regulation when you talk to all the financial markets. And that is certainly due to the popularity of what has been going on in these markets and certainly taking place for quite some time. But I think when you talk about digitization of a currency. We're moving away from paper money. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when we will move away from paper money in its entirety. China now is using a digitized currency. You've got many companies that are accepting digitized currency. You've got many companies that are actively accepting Bitcoin. So it's becoming widely acceptable now on a very escalating basis. But I think we're still in the early stages of what we're going to witness with Bitcoin and digitized currency as we move forward.
Joseph, tell me, so, and forgive my ignorance, but so it's a currency. Does it? You say it fluctuates in value. So it's like the U.S. or the Canadian dollar. It goes up and down with the market. In other words, it did so many bitcoins equal a U.S. dollar, and tomorrow it could take more or less bitcoins to equal a U.S. dollar.
Well, number one, there's a finite number of bitcoins that are in circulation. There's only 21 million of them. So there's a limited amount of them. That's what makes them very valuable. When you talk to the U.S. dollar, we're printing unlimited amounts of money. When you talk about gold and silver, we got limited gold and silver above ground. So that's another asset which is dealt with solely by supply and demand.
And so what's to stop whoever Bitcoin is from producing more Bitcoins, Joseph?
Well, because it's limited right now. There's a limited amount of Bitcoin in circulation. There's only about 21 million coins that we know of.
I see. And is there a current value to each of these coins?
Well, currently we have Bitcoin trading around 31,000 a coin. As you know, it has been to almost 65,000. And about a year ago, we had it down to about 5,000. So it's a widely fluctuating asset class, and I think we're going to see even wider swings as we move forward. But I have no doubt in my mind the ultimate high in Bitcoin is not behind us. It's still in front of us. So we're going to see, I think, gold and silver move up and move up simultaneously with Bitcoin. That'll take place in the second half of 2021 and early into 2022 and beyond, Wayne.
Very interesting. That's very interesting. So does one buy or acquire Bitcoins just as an investment, or is it strictly for spending, Joseph? Is it for using it for doing business, transactions, buying things?
Well, I think right now the answer to that question is it serves both purposes. It enables you to do transactions, and it's an asset that's appreciating in the market.
So do you know, or would you suspect that, like was most famously tried by the Hunt brothers in the silver market, do you suspect that there could be those out there hoarding or stockpiling bitcoins?
Well, there's no doubt we've got very large holders of Bitcoin. Who they are, I don't think anyone truly knows. But there's no doubt that Bitcoin is certainly an asset class which is spreading. More and more people are being involved in the market. When you talk about Bitcoin, there's many different Bitcoins. But I think when you talk about how much the asset class has grown, if you go back, Bitcoin was worth, just to give you an idea, 3 cents in 2008. By 2017, it was worth 18,000. It's currently worth about 31.
Wow. But there is no place to go and sell it for cash. You must use it as a currency, correct?
Well, you can sell it back to the dealer. You sell it in the market, Wayne.
I see. Okay. Wow, that's...
I think ideally everyone should own some Bitcoin. You want to own gold and silver. You want to have some cash for emergency purposes. and you want to certainly protect your investment if you're in real estate or you're in the stock market. I don't think this is certainly the time that you want to go into the stock market, nor is it the time that I think you want to buy a home. I think these markets are both very overheated, and I think we're on the threshold of a very meaningful correction in both asset classes.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joseph. Do you have any feel for, I've heard this word only recently, several times, a super cycle with referring to commodities and you know, it could be metals, oil, it could be both. Do you, with some of these high prices that we've seen and shortages of things, what's your opinion on that? Or is it really at the end of the day, it's all supply and demand? And
well, we're in a super cycle in commodities, and I think we've got a considerable ways to go before the market is complete. But I think when you talk about how big the commodity market could be in the years ahead of us, I think you got to put it in perspective. This is only the sixth time in over 200 years that we've seen a super cycle in commodities. I'll name the previous five for you. You had the War of 1812, you had the Civil War, you had World War I, World War II, Korea, the Cold War, and now the sixth time in 200 years, the ongoing, long-drawn-out War on Terror. So this is, again, a very unique time. This is a unique opportunity, and I think the bull market in commodities, irrespective of what we see in real estate or the equity markets, will continue, Wayne.
That's something. And then you're predicting higher, ever higher energy prices as well, are you not, Joseph?
Well, I think we could see realistically in the next year $100 a barrel oil. I think it's in the cards and it'll happen. We're on our way now into the over 70s, and I think the next stop initially will be around 80 a barrel, but I don't think it'll stop there. I think it'll keep on going. We're going to see fire on the gasoline in the U.S., not a question of this, question of when.
Yeah, and when you say $100 a barrel, it makes me think back a long time ago when I was young, and Prime Minister Trudeau at that time created a law called FIRA, F-I-R-A. That was the Foreign Investment Review Agency that said no foreign country or citizen could own more than 10% of a Canadian enterprise. And so basically the U.S. oil industry sold out its Canadian assets to the Canadian government. But you love this one, Joseph. That was back around 1970, and Canada paid the U.S. companies, FINA and companies like that, for their Canadian assets based on an oil price of $100 a barrel.
Yes.
And I don't know how long it took to get, because it did get to 100 or over one time between now and 1970, didn't it?
Well, if you go back, more importantly, to 1968, and few people realize this fact, you had oil selling at $1.50 a barrel and silver selling at $1.50. They both sold in parity. Very few people understand or realize that, but I remember it because I was in the markets going back those days. That's when we had 32 cent a gallon gas in the U.S.
Yeah, I remember that. I think I remember diesel fuel because it was a byproduct of making gasoline. As a child,
used to sell for half the price of a gallon of gas.
Yeah, I think I recall it as low as 10 or 12 cents a gallon for diesel.
That's what it
was.
Very young.
Yeah. Well, that sure has changed. I don't know if wages and so forth have kept up with it, but boy, it's that sure has changed. It costs a lot of money to fill your vehicle today with fuel.
Well, you used to fill your tank in the old days for $10. Today, to fill your tank's about 70.
That's right. And, you know, despite demonstrations and resistance by citizens and wherever you're talking about, Europe or anywhere else, the government never seems to interfere because the governments get such a big slice. I forget what it is in Canada, but I think at the end of the day, it's something like 35% the government takes off the top.
Yes.
It's like cigarettes and alcohol in Canada, only they get a lot more than 35% on those. They get more like 65% tax. But I remember I had a Volkswagen was my first car, and it was, I think it held 7 gallons, and it cost me $3.50 if I was dead empty to fill up at the Canadian Tire store near our place. So, yeah, it's sure gone up. What's the driving force that could keep these prices of certain metals and commodities high? What is it? Just supply and demand? I mean, are we short copper in the world? Is that why it's been so strong and staying so strong so far?
Well, when I think you talk about gold and silver, there's a limited amount of above ground gold and silver that can be purchased. Most people don't realize the shortages when you talk about buying quantity of gold and silver till you attempt to make a purchase. You call a bullion dealer and you try to buy a sizable amount of gold and silver, and he's going to tell you, quite frankly, he doesn't have the inventory unless you're talking to a very big bullion dealer. So the demand is very strong when you talk about precious metals, when you talk about commodities. When you talk about copper, as I'm sure you'll agree, it's a industrial metal that's in great demand. There's currently a copper shortage.
Right, right, yeah. Yeah, and I guess high technology, electric vehicles, all of these things have contributed to the greater population, cell phones and laptops and so forth. There is a greater demand. The housing boom in Canada, I mean, all these homes have copper wire in them, and most of them do.
Yes.
Anyway. I guess they use some aluminum now. But in Canada here, it's hard to get your house insurance if you have aluminum wiring, I just learned. But, it's something, the commodities at these prices, and, of course, it really affects the price of everything that the consumer buys. I was talking to a truck, you know, a heavy truck dealer the other day, and I said, how much has the increase in the price of steel added to a truck? Not a pickup truck, but like a truck that would have a cement mixer on the back or pull a trailer. And he said close to $20,000 more because of the price of metals now. And so it's pretty significant. I don't know what we're going to see in new car prices, but certainly, you know, the average car still weighs more than one ton. So at the very least, and of course copper, as we said, is up. At the very least, the price of a car, a smaller car, is going to be at least $1,000 more, Joseph, this year, just because of the price of the steel and the copper and so forth. So it's a heck of a time for tough times when the price of everything, and of course we talked about the cost of food, and I don't think that will ever come down, Joseph. I don't know what you think about food.
Well, you know, we've witnessed in the last year, and I'm sure you're aware of it, that used car prices have gone up 30%.
Yes.
Did we ever witness anything like that? Never.
That's right. They say the same thing with the used pickup trucks. They're here in Canada. They're like hen's teeth, and they've gone up as much as 50%. The used pickup trucks. So yeah, it's obviously the new ones are going to be more, Joseph. And with these cryptocurrencies now, is it true? I think your newsletter said there's over 1,200 different ones on the market now.
Over 4,900.
Almost 5,000.
In December 2017, I calculated there were 1,300 cryptocurrencies in the world. We now currently have over 5,000, Wayne.
Wow. And would you believe that they would all succeed, or might we expect some will drop off and maybe new ones come on?
I think some will continue to go higher and some will just fall to the wayside. But when you talk about something, and this is of interest to you, six countries have banned Bitcoin. They're Algeria, Bolivia, Ecuador, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Cambodia. I did the research.
That's something. Why would they have done that, in your opinion, Joseph, or did they say why?
They don't want Bitcoin competing with their currency. That's why they did it.
I see. I see. If the U.S. was to lose its rank as the number one currency, or the bellwether currency, if you will, which currency would be the top currency at that point, as things stand now, Joseph?
Well, I think when you talk about the amount of gold that would be available to back a currency, we've got to look to the Chinese yuan. There's no question China's holding a tremendous amount of gold. Some people think it could be as much as 25,000, 30,000 tons. As you know, the U.S. gold reserves are stated around 8,100 tons. But we've not had an audit of Fort Knox since the height of the Korean War in 1953. So no one knows with absolute certainty how much gold the depository is actually holding.
Ever since that day many years ago, it must be close to 50 years ago when we went off the gold standard. I remember then gold was around $30 or $32 Canadian an ounce.
Yes.
So that's what's, that really is, if we were still on that standard, Joseph, countries couldn't print money the way they are now. Is that right?
Do you know what the official price of gold still is all these years we've been off the gold standard? I know exactly.
What?
$42.50 an ounce. Do you know what the government official price for an ounce of silver is? Take a guess.
I got no idea.
$1.29.
Holy jeez. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks. I hope you can stay with us a few more minutes, Joseph, and we'll be back after these words.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, New Mana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
We'll be right back.
folks. Thank you for joining me today on the Power Hour. It's always great to be with you. And I'm fascinated with this information that flows out of our guest, Joseph Meyer, and he certainly is a wealth of knowledge. At the break, we were talking about, he and I, about cryptocurrencies, and I asked whether he thought it wise for a person to be invested in more than one. And go ahead, Joseph, and tell the audience what you told me about that, please.
Well, I think you want to be invested in more than one cryptocurrency. I think you'd like to ideally own at least three or four. But I tend to think you want to buy the cheapest ones because I think they have the potential to do well as the market in Bitcoin moves forward. But again, I think you got to understand it's a very volatile market, and we're going to see huge moves both up and down as this market moves forward. You got to be prepared for that.
So be prepared to sit. It may not be a short-term thing. It's kind of like
real estate.
Absolutely,
Wayne.
Real estate isn't always a good price when you decide you want to sell something, I know. So I get it. So it's more of a be prepared for it to be a longer term, maybe, Joseph, and don't use money that you might need for something on the short term.
Very important. You couldn't have said it better.
Very good. And what's your view on the job situation in the United States, Joseph? What do you see with regards to unemployment and employment opportunities for Americans?
Well, I think we've got a shortage of skilled people in the marketplace. There's no doubt about it. We've got a lot of industries that are reopening and a lot of people who've been out of work for quite some time, very eager to get back working, and I can understand that. But I think when you talk about unemployment, we've made some tremendous progress over the last couple of months. But I question, once the stimulus runs out, if we can continue to keep the momentum we've built in this area. A lot of people have gotten very lazy, Wayne, and they're very reluctant to go back to work. That's another big problem no one's talking about.
Yeah, indeed, Joseph. Here in Canada, one of the kind of crises is the part-time workers who had been working part-time, whether it's a small retailer, a natural health food store, or anything like that, restaurant, in a kitchen. Our government paid everyone the same. It was $600 a week because of COVID to stay home when many of the part-time workers, of course, weren't making anything near that. So even a student who was, say, working a Saturday shift somewhere, a Saturday evening shift, could get that $600 a week from staying home. So the part-time worker market is next to impossible still here in Canada. And I believe the payments are going to continue through the fall from the last I heard. But I don't think that's the case in the United States. Haven't a bunch of states already stopped the payments? And
yes, they have.
Yeah, well, I think that's about the best move to try and get folks back to work, that's for sure. It's one thing if there's no job available, Joseph. It's another if it's a better deal to stay home because the government's paying you. That's not a good solution, right?
Well, I think there's no question when you talk about wages and you talk about prices. Again, this is a very unique time in history. Never have we seen prices go up and go up as rapidly as they have over the last year. When you talk about wages, I think they've been somewhat depressed for quite some time, although I think the labor market in general is improving. But it's still extremely hard for anyone to support a family on one salary. You need two salaries in which to raise your family. But I think when you talk about the bigger problems moving forward, you talk about the aging population we have with the baby boomers. Did you know we got 10,000 baby boomers that are retiring every day? Do you know that?
Is that right? Wow.
lot of people.
Oh, boy, it is a lot of people. I have no idea what it is in Canada, but I would suspect that per capita, it's the same, you know. Maybe it's 1,000 a day here, but it's a lot of people.
Well, you know, in the old days, you used to work till you were 65. Now you notice in a lot of companies, you have people retiring at 50, 55, and 60. So the demographics of the labor market have certainly changed and changed quite dramatically. No one works till they're 65 today in most industries. You take an early retirement if you're able to when you retire. So we're losing rapidly a lot of very seasoned people in many different industries who've decided now they want to retire and enjoy their retirement years while they're still healthy enough to be able to do it. It's a much different time, Wayne.
That's for sure. No, you make a great point there. I know a lot of people that got buyout packages at age 50 and
took it.
Of course, so many of the government jobs, teachers, for example, I think, even our armed forces, I believe, if you put in your 20 years, you are entitled to a full pension. So, there's a lot of, certainly a lot of experience wasted with this early retirement. And that's a challenge, too, is to, with succession and in a business and trying to have the depth required like a good baseball or a football team. If there was only one pitcher or only one fullback, you know, these teams would be in trouble. But, it's different times indeed. And I agree with you as well. I think that the wages have been suppressed for quite a long while. And I just read an article, Joseph, that some, and this was in the United States, that some enterprises were paying people $2,000, $3,000 and up to $10,000 a year more to work the same position. You know, they're just paying that much more to fill positions now. So it sounds like it may be a good time for eager beavers that really want to get out there, go to work, do a good job, and have a chance of climbing the ladder, so to speak. It's a good time. Wages will be adjusted up. And I heard the other day that a McDonald's hamburger restaurant closed because they could not get the help to run the restaurant. And that's a first.
I remember when the first McDonald's opened in the late 1950s. Hamburger was 15 cents. Coffee was a dime. The apple pie was 15, and so were the French fries.
Yeah. My first business was a Dairy Queen over 50 years ago. And we had a student special because we had two high schools. We were lucky we could stay open the year round. We had a high school directly across the street, and we had one a couple of blocks away. So we had a student special, Joseph, that was a hamburger with fresh vegetables, tomato, onion, lettuce, a small French fry, and a small Coca-Cola for 50 cents. And we managed to make money in small ice cream cones where they were 15, 20, and 25. The real big one was 25 cents. Now it's about $5 to get a good milkshake anywhere.
Absolutely. These were the times we lived them. Very few people who didn't live them can understand how it was possible, but it was.
Yeah. Makes you wonder, doesn't it, Joseph? We used to, back when I was a kid, the milk was delivered to our homes. You could get bread or donuts delivered to your home. I heard in the United States, my wife's from Cleveland, she used to get those cardboard, her folks did get a cardboard barrel of potato chips delivered to the home. And you just wonder how it could be that we could afford such things, you know, that it wouldn't put the price of those products out of reach. But many things have changed, that's for sure. I mean, they just, of course, and then the whole online ordering craze that goes on today for goods delivered to your home. it's kind of gone back to that. And with many of these places, it's no charge. It's free delivery. So it's just very interesting, the things that are happening, and new territory indeed, all of it.
Well, you know, we didn't make very much years ago, but things were very cheap, and you could live nicely on a small amount of money. We're living in a time now where it's even hard to live nicely on a great deal of money, because prices are totally out of whack with wages, and they have been for quite some time. I've said many times in the shows I've done on radio and TV, if you go back and you look at history and you look at wages, if you adjust them for inflation, they're flat in the U.S. since 1965.
Jeez. I remember one set of grandparents, I think their house cost $650. This would have been back in the, I guess, early 40s, 1940s. And I remember my grandma with the glass jars up on the, it was a tiny place, the glass jars up on the shelf, and so many coins in for the mortgage and the gas and electric and so forth, whatever they had. Well, today, geez, the average insurance premium for a car for 1 year was more than a house, a modest house cost then. I mean, it's just,
yes,
it's just hard to put together. I know wages have not gone the same as the cost of goods and homes and so forth. It's remarkable. And you're right. My grandpa was a laundryman, didn't make much money, and yet, you know, we ate just fine, and You wouldn't have called them poor, Joseph. There wasn't a lot of extras, but they certainly weren't poor.
No.
Even though it was just my grandmother did work for a period of time when I guess her children were younger at a factory, a night shift. Many people did that in those days, but it wasn't a whole career. It was, I guess, to get over the hump, you know. And today, as you say, it's so many couples, they both must work, and, you know, I mean, even a wonderful thing like getting pregnant and starting a family, that sure changes the family income and the family expenses, and I think we'll see a lot less large families as we have in the past, Joseph. Just the bare cost will force people to have less children.
Well, I think when you take a look at the bigger economic picture and you take a look at what these CEOs of companies are making compared to the average worker, as you know, going back in the late 60s and early 70s, the CEO of a major Fortune 500 company made about 10 times the amount that the average worker was certainly earning.
Yeah.
The latest figures on the executive compensation of Fortune 500 executives, they're making 300 times the average worker's salary. You got the CEO making about $15.5 million a year and the average worker earning about $43,000. This is totally out of line, and it has to stop. We're not paying the worker near enough to be able to live and raise his family. And these executives at the top can't get enough. It has to end.
No doubt about that. I'll always remember after that last crash and when the U.S. government bailed out so many large corporations, including General Motors.
Yes.
It's usually always the boss's fault. That's how business works. The boss is the president is the one that has in the position to effect change. And so it's usually considered the boss's fault when a company falters or fails or isn't doing well. Well, General Motors certainly wasn't doing well, needing all that money. And when he left, he got a package of some, I forget what it was, Joseph, $25 or $26 million. Had nothing to do with the success of the company or success of his job. These are just these golden parachute deals or whatever they're called that are acceptable today. And you're right. It's completely unfair. And I mean, you look at the athletes today as well, and the movie stars and the some of the people that entertain us one way or another. The pay has gone just out of this world, Joseph. You know, they'll sign a young ball player. They just signed a quarterback right out of college to a 5-year, 50-some-odd million dollar, no-cut contract, and gave him a $7.5 million signing bonus. But you know what the straight truth is? I played baseball and football, and the gospel truth is that the fellas that love playing those games, even in today's dollars, most of them would play for $100,000 a year, and you know, which is still a well above average wage. But when you look at what the pay is, it's just, of course, the average person, the average family cannot go to a professional sports event. It's just simply too much money, from the parking to the food and goodies inside, and then the tickets themselves. It's a real privilege, but didn't used to be that way. My grandfather didn't have much money. That was a laundromat. He took me to a couple of Hamilton Tiger Cat football games when I was very young. No way the man in that position today could do that. There's no way.
I did the research on the ticket prices for the first Super Bowl, which was in 1966. I think you'd get a kick out of this. You had the first Super Bowl, the Green Bay Packers against the Kansas City Chiefs. You know how much the first ticket was to the game? $12.50. You know what the average ticket is to the last Super Bowl? Over $6,000.
My God. Wow, I did not know that. But the $12.50 I could certainly believe, Joseph, because regular games, well, I don't know about in the U.S., but here in Kansas, you know, hockey games and so forth, you would you'd get in for $5 or $8.
Yes.
So the average person, even if only once in a while, could afford that for themselves or their son or their family. Today, it's just out of the question. Some of these hockey tickets, for example, are hundreds of dollars per seat. So, you know, a family could spend $1,000 on an outing. I mean, it's just gone right out of touch. But that's the straight truth. Half these people would play for 1% of what they're being paid. But I guess the agents have done a good job and the owners have made enough money where they just got to keep it all rolling and try and get that ring, Joseph.
When you talk about icons in the sport, professional football, Terry Bradshaw never made enough money that he could take the off-season and not work. He used to sell new cars during the off-season. Terry Bradshaw, who won 4 Super Bowls. He never saw the money these guys are making today. Going back in the 1950s, you used to play professional football on a Sunday and have to go to work on your regular job Monday morning.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know any of my heroes when I was young, football players that didn't sell cars in the off season or real estate or something. They had to supplement their income. And today, my goodness, it's sure not like that. But it's gone out of proportion. Really, it's what one man is worth, $10 or $12 million a year to play a sport. It's just gone silly, really. And yet, oftentimes, at least here in Canada, it's the taxpayer that's paying for the stadiums and the arenas. It's never the team or the owners here. I know it can be different in the United States, but you know, it's basically the government that's paying for a lot of these facilities, and I guess the owners must be doing just fine if they're paying these type of wages. I remember back, I bought all the old ships over a 20-year period from the Steinbrenner family fleet called Kinsman Lines, and I dealt with George Steinbrenner on two different ships, and he was a character for sure. But what really made him, Joseph, was back with the New York Yankees long before internets or anything like that, but they had closed-circuit TV, if you remember. And
Steinbrenner came from CBS News, I remember it.
Are you?
People were from CBS. They had owned it, the Yankees,
prior
to him purchasing the team.
Well, when he did, and this closed-circuit TV came on, he sold subscriptions to watch every Yankee game on this closed-circuit TV. I don't know how it all worked. I watched some Muhammad Ali fights on downtown on a closed-circuit TV at an arena, but this closed-circuit TV and a subscription was $30 a month. And
was in the 70s.
Right, and he sold 1.3 million subscriptions. So the New York Yankees were the first, you know, truly rich team that had money above the rest. And it just grown from there, you know. He told me once, I was talking to a group, you know, being an old ball player myself and, you know, loving it, and a group was going to take over this Canadian team. Now, Canadians don't make that type of money playing football. Most of them need an off-season job still, because the CFL is nowhere near the NFL.
No.
And so we were looking at the Hamilton Tiger Cats, who were doing miserably in my hometown, not drawing the fans. And so I called George Steinbrenner. I had done two business deals with him directly. And I said, I just want some advice and what you think about the likes of the Hamilton Tiger Cats. He said, well, two things. That's Bush League, meaning, you know, kind of amateur, which compared to the NFL, it certainly is. But he said, the other thing, Wayne, the secret is you got to have the rights to the parking and concessions. He
Very
said, most
true.
Teams don't. You know, the Jacobs family financed a bunch of teams. They're from Cleveland, and they got the parking and concessions. He said, I have it at all my racetracks, and that's the key. He said, there's big money there. I'll never forget that. We never, of course, went ahead and did it. It didn't happen. But when I asked him if he'd like to be somehow involved, he said to me, no, that's Bush League up in Canada. I wouldn't be interested in that. But geez,
well, you know, I'll give you another thing that's worthy of thought. When the American Football League was formed in 1960, Lamar Hunt was instrumental in forming the league. I don't know if you remember that.
That's right. Houston Astrodome.
And one of the last teams that was in part of the league was the franchise of the San Diego Chargers. Do you know what you could have bought the franchise for going back in 1960, and they didn't have anybody who even wanted to take a guess?
I wouldn't have any idea.
$25,000.
Holy moly.
You could have owned the San Diego Chargers. And Lamar Hunt said to somebody who was interested, if you don't have the money, I'll loan it to you. This is a once-in-a-lifetime investment. San Diego Chargers today are probably worth $2.5 billion.
Wow. Wow. Oh, they certainly are worth that, no doubt. But
they're paying some of these players more, these owners, than they paid for the franchise.
Yeah, I remember reading, Joseph, that they built the Houston Astrodome, and that was Lamar Hunt. They built the Astrodome for $8 million.
Yes, they did.
In 1960-something, I think. Well, when they built the Sky Dome in Toronto, with the overtime they approved to finish it in time for the baseball season, that was $80 million in overtime.
Yes.
It cost $500 million. And the Ontario government said, we could sell that any day and make a profit, and because it was taxpayer money.
Yes.
Well, about 15 or 20 years later, they sold it to Rogers for $100 million, interest-free, over, I forget, I think 20 years. So, big loss for the Ontario taxpayers. But, boy, how times have changed from $8 million in the 60s to $500 million in the 90s, I believe.
Well, we lived through these eras. We understand what happened and why.
Yeah. I'd heard that stadium in Las Vegas, which is really something looking. I haven't seen the inside, but from the outside. I think I heard that cost over $1 billion, Joseph. Did you hear that?
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, boy. It's really something, the money in sports. But, again, it's a shame up here the taxpayers pay for such a park and then can't afford to go and see any of the games. And for the football, the Canadian football, the Toronto Argonauts, the stadium was empty, about 90% empty. And I thought maybe they could have done a raffle or a lottery and let, you know, so every kid could eventually see a game, but they never did anything like that.
No.
And then sold it for 20% of what they paid for it. I'll bet it isn't paying Ontario's interest payments, Joseph, the money they get from Rogers Communications for buying it. But it's deals like this. You know what else I've noticed? I don't know if you have the same thing in the U.S., but these last 20 years, on an increasing basis, every government building, whether it's a city hall, a fire station, a maintenance department, a university, I swear they must spend a lot on architecture fees.
Yes.
And they all are fancy. They're oftentimes more than what we would afford ourselves as citizens.
Very but true.
The government sure builds themselves some fine digs, I'll tell you. I'd put them in an old warehouse that was empty if it was up to me, Joseph, but they end up with these fancy buildings that cost a lot of money. Even in our little town, you know, the city hall created a debt. The city didn't used to have a debt. Now they do, you know. Well, that's it, Joseph. Thank you for staying on with me as well, and I really appreciate your time. Folks, thanks for joining us on the Power Hour today. It's been my pleasure. And I think I'll be with you in another couple of weeks again. Until then, stay well and keep smiling. Have a great day.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.